We're in the last week of 2014, and it's a good time to take a look back at the year that was.
And today we check out the year in science with Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha and one of our regular science guests here on Central Time. Gemma, good to have you back.
Hello and Happy New Year, gentlemen.
Well, in your latest issue, you looked back at the top science stories of 2014. Number one on the list was the Ebola outbreak. Was it easy to make that call?
Well, there are so many reasons for it. I mean, we've known about Ebola for decades. This is the first time it's really popped out of an isolated outbreak into a real epidemic that is, at last count, 20,000 people infected with the virus, and I think about 7,700 of them have died of it. So this is way, way exponentially bigger than any other Ebola outbreak. It involved a much larger area, multitudes more people. It went global as well. And so there's that aspect of it that makes it really remarkable and newsworthy. But there's also the aspect of it that, as horrible as this outbreak is, it really was a kind of kick in the pants to the research and development of treatment for this horrible virus. And that is the really interesting science part of it, that there are now a number of different therapies and vaccines that they're working on. None of them are, you know, really ready to roll, but it's really speeding up the pipeline. And that, you know, it's a great thing because Ebola is going to be with us forever. It's not going away even after this outbreak winds down, which I hope is soon.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to mention. You know, sometimes stories come and go, and what's hot one year is nowhere the next. But this one has the possibility that it could still be in the 100 top stories next year.
Absolutely. And, you know, hopefully next year we'll be reporting that they found a super effective, super cheap vaccine. Wouldn't that be great? But, you know, they're talking about the World Health Organization and other institutions are talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people potentially being infected with this virus before the current outbreak and epidemic winds down.
And Gemma, before we move on to some of the other top science stories, do you see the reaction to Ebola maybe paving the way toward preparedness, not just for Ebola, but for other world epidemic emergencies like this in the future?
Well, you know, it would be really nice to say, yes, this is going to be the slap in the face that people have needed for a long time. But I hate to say it. As humans, you know, we have notoriously short attention spans, and let's keep our fingers crossed, but I think if we get a good treatment or vaccine for Ebola, that will be a big victory in and of itself.
Moving on to your number two science story for the year, it had to do with the West Antarctic ice sheet collapsing, and that's been going on for some time, but what bumped it up to number two this year?
Well, there were a couple studies that came out this year, I think in March, April timeframe, that really illustrated it has passed the point of no return. And what's happened is as the glaciers have been melting and calving off these monstrous icebergs into the Amundsen Sea, you know, as the glaciers melt, kind of underneath them, the seawater, which is warmer, just kind of creeps up underneath further and further, and the seawater itself is warming as that particular part of the Great Southern Ocean warms. So it's warming and warming, and if you imagine, you know, an ice cube and you're putting hot liquid under it, it's going to melt a lot faster, and that's what's happening. So they're past the point of no return. They're not sure how long it's going to take to melt the entire ice sheet. It could take centuries, but once it's melted, the sea level is going to rise, I think, 10 feet is the figure I'm seeing the most.
So this is potentially dire news in the short to medium term. Are there any hopeful sides that researchers are pointing to on this?
Well, you know, there's still research. that's the key, because this rate is really unprecedented in recorded history, and they're really trying to understand the climate data going back. You know, they have ice cores going back 400,000 years, and they're trying to understand how previous melt and thaw cycles have worked. And, you know, the good news is because it may take centuries, we'll hopefully have enough time to relocate populations and urban centers away from the coast, which is going to be inundated. But I'm sorry, I feel like the Grim Reaper today.
Yeah.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Well, yeah, I was going to say your top two stories, very important stories, worth putting on the list. But on the bad news side, number three, a more hopeful one, up in space.
Yeah, I think number three is an awesome story, and it is all about the Rosetta Comet Rendezvous. I think a lot of us were following it in the late summer and fall as the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft actually went into orbit around a comet 4 billion miles away. And when you think of the achievement, all the things that had to fall into place for that to happen, it is just staggering. And, you know, hats off to the ESA. What a great job. I know that the initial success and jubilation kind of turned to, oh, man, when the lander they dropped in November didn't quite land where they thought it would. It's a solar-powered lander, and it landed in shadow, so it's in hibernation now. And, you know, the thing with that, when I heard that story, a lot of people seem to think, like, oh, so it's a bust. Like, no, it is fantastic that, you know, humans, us puny humans, have a spacecraft in orbit around a comet. And the actual spacecraft, the Rosetta, is going to continue to give us valuable information that's going to take them years to sort out all the data that Rosetta is giving us. So even though the lander had some trouble and is hibernating now, you know, we're still getting a ton of benefit, and it's an incredible achievement.
And let's talk about some of those benefits for a second. What can we learn from landing on a comet?
Well, for starters, we got an up-close and personal first-ever view of the comet's nucleus, and that's the rock and ice that forms its heart. So right away, we're seeing things we've never seen before. We're able to analyze the orbit, the actual path of the orbit, and understand a little bit more about how comets move and work, and just the chemical composition. You know, before it unfortunately switched into hibernation, the lander did send back a lot of information about the chemical composition, some of the information about the rocks, and that's super valuable information that we never had before, and it's, you know, it's a great thing. I'm a big Rosetta fan.
We're talking to Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak about the top stories from the year in science.
And you can join in the discussion, too. What do you think was the most important science news from 2014? What story stuck with you all year long or raised up in your estimation? Give us a call. Join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can also post your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking a look at the year in science with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
And you can join in. What do you think was the most important science story of 2014? Was there science news that you really got excited or curious about? And maybe what are you looking forward to in 2015? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Gemma, we've talked about disease, global warming. We've gone out into space. Now let's get into technology. Another big story on your list was flaws with cybersecurity, and I think you might have gone to press before this whole thing on the interview as well brought cybersecurity really up front in the headlines.
Yes. In fact, our magazine was on newsstands in early December, so we had no chance to report on this. But it kind of really speaks to what our chat with Eugene Spafford, who is a longtime security expert for computers, really the highlights that he made in his chat with us. And his basic point, which I think really whether you're looking at the interview and the Sony debacle, whether you're looking at Home Depot and Target and J.P. Morgan Chase, all of these problems stem from very, you know, dedicated people, very dedicated criminals exploiting really sloppy design. I mean, that's what Eugene Spafford, who we interview, calls it. It's really, we took these general purpose computers and we're asking them to do all kinds of things we, you know, that they were not really designed for. And then when a bug or a glitch or a vulnerability pops up, we just patch it. I mean, think about, you know, if it was the hull of a boat and you just kept patching it. You know what I mean? It would be, you know,
Spack will keep us afloat.
Exactly. And you know, there are only so many patches, and maybe you're not patching it just right. Maybe, you know, another hole opens up. So he really points out that we have to, as a society, really rethink how we approach computer security and stop thinking about patches and start thinking about designing machines for specific purposes, which will innately allow a much higher level of security. Because cyber hackers aren't going away. You know, Ebola, climate change, cyber hackers, they're not going away. I'm sorry, I'm such the Grim Reaper today. I apologize.
So what are we supposed to do? Who's supposed to take the lead on this? Is this going to come out of the private sector? Is it something government should get involved in?
Well, that's a really good question. And in fact, we asked him that very question. And he basically sees this as something that really should be taken up on a local scale. You know, we've got these local extension services for, say, agriculture. If you find a weird bug in your garden, you can contact someone and say, hey, you know, what's this bug about? And if we could do that with computers rather than, you know, try to contact some shadowy government organization, and it would make the reporting and the fixing hopefully much smoother. And he explains it much more eloquently than I can in 10 seconds, but he does have a solution.
I'm going to jump down a little further on your list, Gemma. I know you are a big fan of stories about human prehistory, human evolution, where we came from, and a story that we actually talked to you briefly about earlier this year, maybe a mystery solved, a DNA sequence of an ancient American human genome.
Yeah, this is a really exciting story, and I remember chatting with you briefly about it last winter, but it's even gotten more exciting because in February, they sequenced the first ancient American. They sequenced his DNA from an infant boy known as Anzac I, and they found out that his people were directly ancestral to 80% of Native Americans and very closely related to the other 20%. They also were able to trace his lineage back to Siberia. So this really is the first time that through DNA sequencing, we can definitively say, yes, the first Americans came over from Siberia over the land bridge that was between Siberia and Alaska. And this is important because there were alternate theories mm-hmm. floating about saying, no, they came from Europe, they came from here, they came from there. But so we finally have definitive DNA proof. And then in May, you know, just a couple months later, another ancient first American skeleton's DNA was sequenced. And we learned a little bit more about the fact that she, too, you know, clearly related the same way to those Siberian peoples coming over the land bridge. But we also learned a lot more about their facial features, their facial morphology, because her skull, she was a teenage girl, and researchers named her Naya. Naya's skull was found. The remains were found with the skull. So we were learning a lot more about the first Americans, which has always been, you know, a big question mark, because mm-hmm. we haven't had really solid, hardcore DNA data.
So back the doom and gloom for a second here as we move on to number eight. A story here about scientific fraud within the scientific research community. And I know, you know, we're not supposed to trust stuff on the internet, but when it comes to like peer-reviewed journals and so forth, we can't trust things there either?
Well, I want to disagree with you. I don't think this is a doom and gloom story. I think this is actually, there is a silver lining in this story. As we looked at, you know, it's tragic that this one senior researcher took his own life because the paper he supervised another researcher writing was retracted. And there have been a number of other incidents in 2014 of papers where either the statistics were made up or the photos were fudged, all different kinds of issues. And, you know, the authors of this article point out that one of the reasons there seems to be more fraud is that scientists as a community are actually policing themselves better. So there seems to be more fraud out there because they're getting better at finding it, and that's actually a good thing. You know, so the peer-reviewed journal article will always kind of be the gold standard for credibility, but now scientists are looking at it much more closely and not just taking it, you know, oh, it's peer-reviewed in a quality journal, we're good. They're trying to replicate the results of experiments and really kind of knock down any theories. And that's a good thing because science is all about testing, retesting, and exploring possible new explanations.
Well, Gemma, I don't want to get through the year in science without bringing up a dinosaur. And the Spinosaurus made an appearance on your list, or Spinosaurus, correct me either way.
I call him Spinosaurus.
Okay, good.
So I think we're good. But yeah, this is a fantastic, and it's exciting, and it's good news. Yay! Spinosaurus aegypticus is the largest land predator ever known, which that in itself is super cool because it's bigger than T-Rex, but that's not really the most interesting thing about it. It is a crazy Frankenstein dinosaur. It is nuts. It's got like a crocodilian snout. It has these weird flat feet that they think were webbed. It's got a 7-foot-high sail on its back. So it has all these bizarre features that for years they couldn't figure out what the heck this thing was, and then they found this new skeleton that answered a lot of the questions. And the answer is, it's so weird looking because it is the first and only aquatic dinosaur we've ever found. That's why it has all these weird things. Like, for example, it's the only dinosaur that has no central cavity in its limb bones. We see that in like hippos and penguins and other aquatic animals because it spent most of its time in the water. And I just think that's really cool because, you know, we always think, oh, with dinosaurs, yeah, we know so much already. Now we're just kind of filling in the little gaps in the record. And the truth is, here is a huge gap of the record that we didn't really appreciate how weird and odd and wonderful it was until this year.
Well, Gemma, thanks for sharing those. A lot of other really interesting stories on your list, and we'll be talking about a lot more in 2015. Thanks for joining us.
Sounds great, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. That's Gemma Tarlak. She is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha with us today to talk about the year in science, and she joins us usually once a month to talk about some, you know, some of the most intriguing stories that are going on throughout the year here on Central Time.